Thank you. Hello, everyone. This is another PIR of iOS 10, 11, and 12. We start this post-implementation review of iOS 10, 11, 12 in September 2019. And in the first phase, we identified matters the board might examine in a request for information. This consultative document was published in December 2020. Agenda Paper 5 provides an overview of the matters examined in the request for information. Feedback from the first phase was that the standards are generally working as intended. For example, stakeholders support the single basis for consolidation in iOS 10. At today's meeting, we would like to hear your views or initial feedback from your jurisdictions on these matters. This meeting is in the mid of the comment period. We have been undertaking outreach activities since the publication of the document. But generally, outreach activities have confirmed the matters identified by the board, and overall, the standards are working as intended. I do not plan to present the individual matters in Agenda Paper 5, as the aim of this meeting is to hear your views. We are also interested to hear if you found the overview session, the introduction session we held in January for national standards data and the distribution material, whether they are useful or not. I will now turn over to Jay Ho, my colleague from Korea, who has kindly offered to provide an overview on initial findings from Korea. Now, Jay Ho, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Jen. We have comments and observations to make based on our preliminary outreach in our jurisdiction across many areas that the request for information already identified. But in the interest of time, let me just highlight two areas among others. First of all, explanatory disclosure on control assessment. In many situations, control assessment is highly subjective and very complex because facts and circumstances are not that definitive, but ambiguous and uncertain. So some analysts even call into question the control assessment made by the company and find that they are not able to 100% rely on the consolidated financial statement, especially when it comes to the scope of consolidation. So let me give you an example. An investor company holds significant amounts of investment in five investee companies, and includes only three of those five invested companies in their consolidated financial statement. But analysts think otherwise. So analysts perceive all of those five invested companies to be within the consolidated group. So in that case, analysts will do their own homework on their own by adding up the individual financial statements of all the five invested companies on their own. So this means there's a discrepancy between accounting result and user's perception. So in such case, I think providing explanatory disclosure on control assessment could be helpful. And iOS 12 already requires such information to be disclosed. In particular, when a company determines that it does not have control, even though it holds more than 50% of shares, or vice versa. However, as we observe, quite a few companies fail to faithfully apply such disclosure requirement. For example, many companies tend to simply disclose their judgment itself on whether they have control or not, without mentioning any concrete reason behind their control assessment. So in this regard, I think company needs to disclose faithfully information used in their control assessment so the users can understand their rationale behind the control assessment. And also we believe that adding illustrative examples of such disclosure, explanatory disclosure to I-plus 12 will help improve the disclosure practice. That's the first one. And secondly, guidance on structured entities. We suggest the ISB should consider providing specific guidance on control assessment of structured entity, because there seems to be a high tendency for companies to use special purpose vehicles as a way of financing. And preparers and auditors are more likely to face trouble when they deal with accounting for special purpose vehicles. Also, because special purpose vehicles are commonly used in practice, the judgment on whether they have control, over the special purpose is likely to have very significant impacts on the financial position of the reporting entity. Compared to the previous standard, which is SIC 12, the control assessment of structured entity under I-plus 10 has become very challenging. It is because the involvement in the design of a special purpose vehicle was a strong indicator of a control under SIC 12. But under I-plus 10, being involved in setting up a special purpose vehicle is not sufficient in itself to conclude that the investor has control over the structured entity. So in that sense, I think the time has come for the ISB to revisit their past decision that there should be a single section that combine guidance on all sorts of control assessment and explore whether there is a need for providing guidance specifically dedicated to control assessment of structured entities. Thank you.
Thank you, Jae-ho.
Thank you.
Patricia, would you like to come in?
Thank you very much, Sue. We're in the middle of our outreach program, and we're starting to collect a lot of small, what I would call small concerns, more guidance needed here, something else needed there. What we haven't found is any hot potato type topic like we had with Goodwill in the IFRS 3 PIR. So we've got the issues that Jae-ho's already brought up. They're covered. We're hearing that we do need a lot more guidance on control and various aspects of control, including things like definitions of returns. We're hearing from users that they have real problems when an investment changes state. So it might go from associate to subsidiary, from subsidiary to discontinued operation, that they don't get enough information of the transfer to understand what's really happening. Like Jae-ho, we're hearing that more information is needed on why the basis for the assessment of control, assessment of joint operation, assessment of joint venture. So it's again, it's a more information wanted issue. We're generally hearing satisfaction with the investment entity's exception. And when we get to IFRS 11, we are finding that there is some confusion between joint operations, particularly in separate financial statements. And we are getting some calls for investment for proportionate consolidation to be returned to use, and so more information from users also under IFRS 12 on things like non-controlling interests and collaborative arrangements. We hear a call for the ISB to provide guidance on collaborative arrangements, but what we don't have at the moment is the sort of fact patterns that are leading to this concern. So we're not yet in a position to come to you with what where the real issues are. It's more a general call at this stage. So a lot of general concerns, relatively minor, a bit more guidance here, a bit more guidance there, and cover a few things like that. And of course, finally, we are getting calls that, as you haven't included the IAS 28 in the PIR, it increases the importance of the equity method project so that that can be brought up to match everything else that's going on. So I think that summarizes where EFRAG is, what EFRAG is hearing. Thank you.
Thanks, Patricia. Linda.
Thanks very much. This project is very important in Canada, so we've been, done a fair amount of outreach. So far, we've had discussions with our IFRS discussion group, our user advisory committee, our academic advisory committee. We've had discussions with both real estate preparers and real estate equity analysts, and also with the Canadian Bankers Association. Given some of these discussions, we're happy that the ISB staff or board members have been able to attend virtually, so you've gotten some of this feedback directly as well. And based on this discussion so far, we're actually planning some additional outreach sessions. We're going to be talking to the oil and gas sector, the mining sector, the cannabis sector, and to some investment entities in the next few weeks. So this is preliminary in terms of where we are. On IFRS 10, we're getting some feedback relative to the notion that doing the assessment of control is very difficult in development stage companies. This came back from someone in the cannabis sector, so we're going to pursue that. They said that identifying the relevant activities in these companies is difficult to do because of the stage of development. And also from our IFRS discussion group, the notion of de facto control guidance, it can be difficult to apply in a private company setting. And so we'll give you more color on that in terms of our comment letter, but we will be looking at that as well. And then in the REIT sector for IFRS 10, they noted that the guidance on assessing rights that give an investor power focuses more on something like traditional manufacturing, and it's less clear how to apply it when you have an entity, the owners of a single asset entity. And so that was from a real estate preparer. With regard to IFRS 11, a lot of noise, and you've already, I'm glad someone else said it first, the notion of difficult to assess whether something can be classified as a joint operation. To distill the comments down, they're focused largely on IFRS 11 B29 to B32, and the feeling that the legal form takes so much precedence over the actual substance of the arrangement, and it's very difficult to overcome that hurdle. And users in particular were focusing on that. And so we have quite a number of examples there that we will pass along. So that's coming somewhat from the real estate sector as well. And on IFRS 12, echoing what Patricia said, there is still some love for the proportionate consolidation method in some circumstances, and users were commenting on that. And we'll give you those facts as well. But in general, what's manifesting there, that with the absence of that ability to use that, some entities are using non-GAAP measures to actually give the proportionate consolidation results. And so in particular in this area, the users were focusing on the types of information they really wanted that they didn't seem to be getting as a result of the disclosure requirements in IFRS 12. Things like the governance structure, the access to funds, some case where it wasn't apparent to users of the information, And so we will include these examples likely in appendix to our comment letter, but I want to emphasize that this is a kind of an effort in progress, and we'll finish our outreach before we can conclude officially on our comment letter.
Thanks, Linda. Can't fault you on your specificity there with that paragraph reference.
I have good staff.
Vincent.
Thank you, Sue. Good afternoon to everybody. So in France, we have a working group that is working on this project, but unfortunately, the working group started its work at the beginning of the month, so we are quite at an early stage in our process. However, we had preliminary discussions, and I can give you a whiff of what you should expect in our comment letter. As a foreword, it's quite important to flag a comment that came up quite often among our stakeholders, is that they observed that the post-implementation review is coming quite long after the effective date of the free standards, almost 7 years in Europe. So this has two implications. The first implication is that practice has developed since then to respond to the practical challenge that stakeholders might have met when they implemented the standards. And the other implication is that some stakeholders they have not changed their mind in relation to some requirements that they viewed as being controversial when the free standards were developed 10 years ago. But now we are 7 years after the initial application of the standards, and now they are part of the accounting landscape. So that may explain why there is no hot potato, just to take the sentence of Patricia, in relation to this post-implementation review. So now if I have a look at the free standards, so there is no issue in relation to IFRS 12. With regard to IFRS 10, it's quite important to flag two high-level comments, is that our stakeholders have the feeling that the control-based approach for consolidation is working well and is dealing efficiently with most fact patterns. Of course, there are some very tricky situations that might require further analysis and that would maybe deserve additional guidance in the standard, but it's properly addressing most of the circumstances stakeholders face. And IFRS 10 requires the use of judgment, but it's not a surprise, and it's pretty consistent with your expectation and the stakeholders' expectations. And obviously, preparers and auditors are quite satisfied at the moment with the way this judgment is being applied. There are a few matters of particular interest in our jurisdiction. The first one is identifying relevant activities that can be tricky in some circumstances, in particular when relevant activities are changing over time, and determining the relevant activities that most significantly affect the investee's returns when several investors have decision-making rights in relation to other different activities. So this is the first point. The other point that is subject to quite extensive discussion is the substantive versus protective rights. Identifying those rights might be quite challenging and can require the use of significant judgment. And it's quite interesting to see that sometimes people are picking some formal US guidance and quantitative thresholds to assess whether a protective or substantive, whether a right is protective or substantive. And on that matter, the preliminary view of our stakeholders is that maybe there should be further application guidance in IFRS 10 in this respect. And the third area subject to discussion is the section called accounting requirements in the request for information. And this point has triggered many comments in respect to the interaction and/slash consistency of IFRS 10 with other standards. We are performing additional outreach with regard to issues that are specific for financial institutions, notably the agent versus principal, because at the moment it is very specific to some industries, so we will assess whether the stakeholders are satisfied with the requirements in IFRS 10 in this respect. And a last comment on IFRS 10 is that we don't expect to provide any feedback on investment entities because the case of we don't come across such kind of entities in France in general. So we don't have much to say. On IFRS 11, so in that case, maybe there will be more extensive discussion in this respect. So there are two main comments emerging at this stage. The first one is that stakeholders are now used to determining whether a joint arrangement is a joint venture or a joint operation. But there is some dissatisfaction, I would say, among some preparers about the outcome of that assessment. There is a perception that it's quite difficult to end up with a joint operation classification. And some stakeholders think that in some circumstances, it's quite difficult to overcome the legal form of the entity, and that you end up with a joint venture, while they think that in some circumstances, the joint operation classification would provide more useful information. And there are also many questions about how to deal with the other facts and circumstances in assessing whether a joint arrangement is a JV or a joint operation. And there are questions about whether it is a lack of guidance in the standard or it is the way the standard is enforced by auditors or regulators. The second point of attention with regard to IFRS 11 is the accounting requirement when you have a joint operation. So this matter has been in the limelight since 2019 when the Interpretation Committee issued an agenda decision, and there was some, I can say that some stakeholder was quite surprised with the outcome, and it shed lights on the fact that the accounting requirements for joint operation are not entirely clear for everybody. So we expect some discussion in that respect. And the last point that I wanted to mention on IFRS 11, you might know that the end of the proportional consolidation method was very controversial at the time in our jurisdiction. So this post-implementation review will be the occasion for us to take stock of the situation now, to assess how entities have adapted to that change, or users have also adapted with that change. So we also expect to have a very interesting discussion in that respect. But here again, just a caveat, those are preliminary views and we still have much work to do to prepare our comment letter. So don't take all our comments for granted. Thank you.
Okay, I see Sue is frozen. I'm back in the meantime. Yu Chen.
Okay, thank you, Hans. After the request for information, the PIR of IFRS 10, 11, 12 was published by the ISB last December. We immediately post the Chinese version on our website, and we are still in the process of seeking for feedback. We have only received a few comments from stakeholders. So based on the feedback we received so far, most of the stakeholders believe that this IFRS 10, 11, 12 general are working well. These three standards, I mean, this project is very important in China. These standards have always been the focus of the capital market and have great impact on entities. Similar to others' comments, we think the big issue is that a lot of assessment or judgment are used for the implementation of these standards. So more guidance could be very helpful for the implementation. Here, I would like to share some of the issues raised by our stakeholders so far. There are four issues. The first one is about identifying the relevant activities of an investee. Under some circumstances, it's very difficult to identify the relevant activities of the investee. For example, entities may have different relevant activities at a different stage of development. So sometimes it's difficult to judge control according to current ability to direct the relevant activity. That's the first issue. The second issue is about the distinction between substantive rights and the protective rights. Although both the substantive rights and the protective rights are defined in the IFRS standards, but in practice, due to the complicated design of contract terms, it's difficult to clearly determine whether the rights held by the investor are substantive rights or protective rights. That's the second issue. The third issue is about the distinction between a principal and an agent. In practice, there is a lot of room for judgment when making assessment on whether the investor is the principal agent. In particular, the judgment in determining control under special circumstances is very difficult and sometimes very controversial, especially when VIE or structured entities are involved. We have the similar comments feeling with the KSB. The fourth issue is about the recognition and accounting treatment for collaborative arrangement outside the scope of IFRS 11. On page 27 of the request for information indicates that collaborative arrangements do not qualify as joint arrangement as defined in IFRS 11 because of a lack of joint control. From the preliminary feedback from stakeholders, in practice, this would happen, especially in industries such as real estate, film production, drug research and development, and telecommunications, and so on. For example, two parties jointly carry out a certain operation. One party directs some part of the relevant activities, while the other party directs another part of the relevant activities. And the two parties share the returns of the operation. Although in the contract, this arrangement may not meet the definition of joint control, but there are many things in common with the joint venture described in IFRS 11. So that's just a simple example. We suggest more research on this kind of structure and providing further guidance at the standard level. That's the four issues identified by our stakeholders so far. In the next step, we will still continue to collect the feedback from stakeholders and conduct further outreach activities with stakeholders. We are also looking forward to the joint outreach activities with the ISB in early April. Hopefully, we will provide you with some detailed examples based on our outreach activities and provide our formal comment letter to the ISB. Yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Yu. Noble.
Yes, thank you, Hans. Again, we are currently in the process of conducting outreach with our constituents, so my comments today are going to be preliminary. I have 2 points, but they are very similar to what Patricia has mentioned. First is that while the request for information doesn't necessarily refer to IS 28, we are receiving many comments on the application of the equity method. And the ASPJ is currently doing some work on in this area, and we hope to present our findings in future ASAP meetings. Secondly, there are many concerns from preparers, users, and auditors in our jurisdictions about the accounting when there's a change in state, as Patricia mentioned, especially when the existing or retained interests are remeasured at fair value when there is a change in state. The constituents are concerned that it has the same effect as selling those interests, which in their view is very hypothetical and not necessarily representationally faithful. Thank you.
Thank you, Noble. Mary would like to make a comment.
Yeah, a couple of observations that turn into requests for people as they're finishing their outreach. One is, as you look through the questions in the invitation to comment, you'll notice that in a number of areas we've reported that our the phase one research identified requests for comment, and certainly we're seeing some of those repeated in your preliminary reports today. You'll notice that the questions in the ITC are very much focused on looking for information about the frequency with which these occur, their impact, and the usefulness of information. And the reason for that, and I want to encourage you to think about this in developing your responses, is that adding guidance for situations that occur relatively infrequently may be very helpful for the people who do face that issue, but it adds complexity for everybody who has to pick up and apply the standard. So I think that's one of the things that we'll be trying to balance as we work through the feedback, is the frequency, and particularly, you know, one observation I'd make, and I guess it's the residual auditor in me, is to think about whether we're getting unique instances of reporting an issue. And what I mean is, particularly where jurisdictions overlap, are we hearing from the same people in different settings about a fact pattern that may come up once a week, once a month, or once a year? You know, just to get a better sense of frequency, so we can assess that. Because if we try to provide guidance for every issue that people have requested it for, the standard would be as big as the whole bound volume is right now, at least one of the books of the bound volume. So I think that's something we'll have to judge. I've been interested and a bit relieved by the comments I've heard so far about judgment and the need for judgment, and people acknowledging that is necessary. You know, that's what you're hearing. I think with judgment, what we'd be particularly interested in, if you see an area where it's challenging, is whether people think that the framework is inadequate for making consistent judgments or not. Because I, you know, some of the preliminary feedback we heard was, it's too hard and there's too much judgment. Can't you make it simple and just develop some bright lines? And I think that's generally viewed as a not very useful way to go, especially when you have arrangements that have a lot of risk sharing and complex arrangements. But I think it's quite important for us to hear if people think there's a pattern of difficulty because the objective or the framework is insufficient for making the kind of judgments that are necessary. So just a couple of areas that I wanted to flag as of particular interest in reflecting on the comments that we're hearing from people. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary. Mark.
Thank you. Really helpful there, just to follow on from Mary, because based on our preliminary outreach, I think the sort of headline message is that the standards are working well, and there aren't sort of particular problems, but there are a number of areas where stakeholders are asking for additional guidance. Examples of that would be one picked up in the pack that was sent out, application issues with the interpretation of requirements regarding non-contractual agency relationships, a call for guidance there. Returns and the board's decision that it wasn't necessary to refer to instruments that absorb variability in IFRS 10 and additional guidance there. Not really specific issues for IFRS 11. Based on our sort of monitoring and inspection work, the quality of disclosure arising from IFRS 12 is poor, but we believe that's because of compliance issues, not any sort of underlying issue with the standard itself. A couple of other areas, rights that give investor power. So could more be done to improve the guidance on distinguishing between substantive and protective rights? And for example, the rights to appoint and remove board members, control without majority of voting rights, and in particular in the financial sector where there are partnership arrangements. And also we're going to be exploring more with our stakeholders some of the concerns that they've flagged around classifying of joint arrangements. But I think sort of given Mary's steer, what we'll do in the remainder of our outreach is really try and quantify these concerns better so that when we feed into the board, we can come up with some more granular examples of numbers. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Rieko.
Thank you. I'm going to share some of the feedback from AOSSG members. The members raised issues on the areas which are already noted by the ISB, such as identification of relevant activities in complex situations, assessment on a principal or an agent, collaborative arrangements outside the scope of IFRS 11. Several members commented on protective rights, so I'm going to share that issue now. The members said it is challenging to determine whether veto rights are substantive or protective. One member commented, for example, challenges are seen when SPEs are involved. That member noted there is diversity in practice in determining whether the lender's veto right on investment decisions of the SPE is substantive or protective. IFRS 10, paragraph B28A, provides an example of a lender's protective right, but it is useful if the definition of protective rights is further clarified and also additional guidance is provided on how to assess whether the veto right is substantive or protective. For other points raised, I'm going to send the details after this meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Rieko. Raymond.
Thank you, Hans. I think the feedback that we've had, we've got a lot of jurisdictions that are starting to go through their consultation process at the moment, but the feedback that we've had has been very positive about the way that the standards are working, that the application is happening in practice and so forth. But what's we've heard the consistent message around more guidance in certain areas, some of the areas that have really been mentioned in this meeting, so I will not go back, I'll not go into detail on that. Things like, you know, at what point do you, you know, does control exist, and when transition happens from one state to next, you know, how the accounting for that works. So I guess once the comment letters come through, we'll provide a little bit more information on that. Where we are seeing people are concerned is when we're dealing with structured entities, specifically in some jurisdictions, we've got what we call collective investment schemes and how those are accounted for. And again, sometimes you'll find that depending on how the ownership structures of the various vehicles works, that may create some problems in terms of the judgment call, that, you know, in terms of the call, in terms of which way, you know, whether or not a vehicle is controlled by the reporting entity. So I guess those examples will come through as part of the feedback that I think that by the various people that are going to come. There's also some concern that's been raised about the relevant activities and identification of the relevant activities of organizations. So again, that's something that I think we'll provide some feedback on. We'll provide some details on to see whether or not there's any more guidance that may that is able to be provided on that. And then I spoke about the change in types of investment. So I think that's pretty much it that we've got so far. But given that I think we're still in the early stages, there may be more comments that will come through as the common process develops. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Raymond. Finally, Leonardo.
Yes, thank you. Considering my recommendation, I just want to highlight a couple of matters relating to IFRS 11 that are significant for us. The first one is that some preparers, especially preparers operating in the oil, gas, and construction sectors, told us that the requirements of IFRS 11 regarding the classification of a joint arrangement should be simplified, in particular the part on other facts and circumstances, because this part is causing divergence in practice, and sometimes they disagree with the outcome of this assessment. In my understanding, they would like to classify more joint arrangement as joint operation. The second matter that we have observed on IFRS 11 relates on the accounting requirements for joint operation. Some stakeholders disagree with the Interpretation Committee decision on the liabilities that a joint operator shall recognize when he signs a contract, for example, a lease contract, on behalf of the joint operation. They think that the joint operator should recognize only a share of the liability and not the entire liability arising from the contract. These, for the moment, are our main comments. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Leonardo, for your comments. Does the staff want to make further comments at this point?
Thank you, Hans. We look forward to your written feedback to the request for information, which we believe that you can provide some of the useful example to us to analyze. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. So we have a break of 15 minutes planned at this moment. I suggest we resume our meeting at 5:21 British time. Thank you.